each of them very different, yet all seem to be struggling with the same issues, a set of issues that confront all of us, issues such as fear of loss and death, loneliness, the search for meaning in our lives. And the book talks about how both his patients and Dr. Yalom himself changed and grew as a result of their interaction. And he suggests that perhaps by coming to understand these people and their struggles, maybe we will understand ourselves a little bit better. He writes about it like this in the introduction to his book. He says, "Though these tales of psychotherapy abound with the words patient and therapist, do not be misled by such terms. These are every man, every woman stories. Patienthood is ubiquitous. The assumption of the label is largely arbitrary and often dependent more on cultural, educational, and economic factors than on the severity of pathology. Since therapists, no less than patients, must confront these givens of existence, the professional posture of disinterested objectivity so necessary to scientific method is inappropriate." He says, "We psychotherapists simply cannot cluck with sympathy and exhort patients to struggle resolutely with their problems. We cannot say to them, you and your problems. Instead, we must speak of us and our problems, because our life, our existence, will always be riveted to death, love to loss, freedom to fear, and growth to separation." He says, "We are, all of us, in this together." The book has recently come out. It's published by Basic Books. And he's speaking with us this morning by telephone. As we talk with him, perhaps you will have some questions. Our telephone number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you may hear us. That number is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Just remember, those numbers are different. And at any point here in our conversation, if you'd like to join in, please do pick up the telephone and call. Dr. Yalom?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
The book, as I say, it presents the stories of 10 individuals, and I'm sure that we wouldn't have enough time to talk about all of them. Perhaps we can talk about some, and also I have to recognize that the stories that you present in your book are also they seem to be pared down to the essentials. Obviously, they were the result of months of conversations with people, and we're going to be presenting even more pared down stories still. It seems to me that runs the risk of making it all sound too easy.
I think that's very true. But, of course, that's true in any literary adventure. You simply find the story in the individual's life, and you don't, as you know, spend a lot of time talking about how the individual gets dressed that morning or what he eats for breakfast. So I've taken months of therapy and looked for the story in the therapy and kind of framed that. And perhaps I've left out, I think, a lot of the hard work that goes on and simply getting to know them.
Let me have you talk about that for a moment. Did you worry when you were writing these stories that it would present an image of a therapy that would make it look too easy, that the struggle maybe didn't come across as it should have?
Well, there are some that I deliberately threw myself into the struggle so that I would try to depict just that issue. For example, the very first patient in the title story called Love's Executioner, and also the story shortly after that called The Fat Lady. Mm-hmm. Love's Executioner was the story of a woman who was so totally engrossed in someone else, in a love affair that she had had 8 years ago, that she simply would not let me into her life. And even when she did, to some extent, she ended up being a very circumstantial, tangential woman who simply did not want to engage me. So the therapy was extremely frustrating and irritating, and I, in a sense, the story largely was about that. And so also for the story of the fat lady, one of the aspects of that story was that this was a woman who bored me a great deal. And so I tried to write the story around what boredom means to the therapist and why that boredom should in fact be considered data, because of the fact that if the patient bores you, the chances are, one of the things that we learn in psychotherapy is that the same thing is true for other people.
perhaps we can talk a little bit more about these two individuals. The woman whose story is forms the title from which you take the title, Love's Executioner. This was a woman of 70, I believe. She came to you. She was very unhappy. She had a lot of problems with depression. She had attempted suicide. She had 8 years before had a brief affair with, in fact, another therapist, although at the time of the affair, he was not treating her, but that was how she had met him.
That's right. He had been her therapist once.
And she had had this affair 8 years before, and he very abruptly had broken it off. And she said that it was making her miserable. She thought about him constantly all this time. She didn't understand why he had brought it to such an abrupt conclusion, and was very concerned with knowing, with understanding that, but even more with knowing what she said was, with knowing how he felt about her. She seemed to really want to know that he still cared, and while she recognized that there was very little chance that they would reestablish this relationship, she was holding on to I think she said 1%. She said, well, maybe there's just a 1% chance that the relationship could be resumed. And it seemed that the rest of her life was so unhappy, and that this, she said, was the only time in her life that she had any happiness, so she was desperately clinging to the possibility, however slim, that she could have that happiness again. And when she came to you, she was in great distress and said to you, you're the last resort, and talked quite a bit about and during the time that you talked with her, she continued to talk about committing suicide.
Well, there are several striking aspects of that kind of story. You know, the first is that she should be living her life 8 years ago, as she put it, so that nothing in the present was really lived and experienced as in real time for her. And there's something really tragic about someone, in a sense, giving up her life for this illusion, something that happened so long ago. You know, what kind of love is that anyway? And what kind of relationship is it when you have a feeling towards another person that if only they could just think of you 5 minutes a month, if she could have a brief conversation with him once a year, if she only knew that he thought well of her in the world, then she could be all right. There's something very odd about that. It's sort of giving up your whole freedom, your whole power to someone else, as though he's not anything more than just one other human being who, for all she knew, might even have been dead by that time, you know, or not, certainly not thinking of her.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt this was a strange kind of love. It was not a real love. It was a counterfeit love, some sort of variant of love. And that was why I felt that my first task in therapy was to somehow to dissolve this love so that she'd have something to relate to me with, some energy. That's why I thought, well, my job here is to be the executioner of love. That's hence the title of the book.
Mm-hmm. And I think one can sense your frustration in dealing with her, because you continue to try to have her confront the reality of the situation, the fact that she hasn't talked to this person in 8 years. You seem to keep coming back to that, and yet she doesn't want to let go of the 1%.
That's right. Just the slim chance that somehow they can reestablish it. And it's hard to know whether or not her life is so empty because of the fact that she devotes it entirely to this memory, or whether or not, in fact, she devotes herself to the memory because her life is so empty. Mm. You know, those two play together in a sort of dynamic interaction.
You made an agreement with her to continue the therapy for 6 months. And
okay,
as you were getting near the end and feeling that you weren't getting anywhere, you thought perhaps the thing to do would be to get this other person, this young man, to meet with the two of you, for them to have a meeting and to talk about what had happened between him and the aftermath. Was that a difficult thing to get to that point where you decided that that was the thing to do, a direct kind of confrontation?
Well, everything else had failed with her. And at some point in my treatment with her, I had asked her the question, as I, the question I often will ask someone who's caught in the throes of some sort of obsessive feeling about another person, is there any possible release for you? Is there something this other person who has so much power, so much magic, is there something he could do or say that would simply release you? Could you construct the perfect scenario in which you would be let go? And then she did. She imagined, we role-played for a minute, she imagined what she thought he would say. And at that point I got the notion, well, if everything else failed, I'll try that. I'll try to bring him into therapy, and we'll see. We'll see whether or not perhaps something he says might resemble that scenario. And so when the weeks were, just a few weeks were left, I decided that I'd try this. I will try anything in therapy if I think that it's going to be helpful to the patient. And certainly I was feeling rather desperate in this instance.
Mm-hmm.
So we got him in, and as a matter of fact, he was very willing to come in, although he had not been willing to answer her calls for several years, because he too needed a certain kind of release. She was making his life miserable with constant calls, constant recordings on his taping machine, letting him know every time she changed therapist and who she was seeing, and calling him on birthdays and anniversaries. So he too wanted some release from her. So they came in, and we had a very dramatic three-way meeting. But that's the very punchline of the story. I don't think I should say any more about that.
Hmm. I don't want to give away too much, but something that I wonder about it in this story is it seems to have come to a conclusion that is rather unsatisfactory. It seems one really wonders, although it seems that she was improved, one really wonders how much change there was, and I get the sense on your side that perhaps you weren't really very satisfied with the conclusion either, because while she managed to let go of her obsession in large part, she didn't completely. I mean, she ends up still having some relationship with this man, and perhaps that's not. Perhaps there's nothing wrong with that, and yet it seems that she's still, in some fashion, was holding on to her 1%.
Yeah. Oh no, I was very dissatisfied with the outcome. I had a lot of, I had my ambition for her. I think was much too great. I wanted her to make some substantial changes, and once after the three-way meeting, which had been in a sense a very powerful but also painful meeting for her, in which she learned some things about that affair, some striking things about that affair, her obsession was for momentarily exploded, and she came in the next week without the obsession and very depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get an idea of what the obsession meant to her. She said that it was like she was now she had been living in a magic theater, and suddenly had come outside, and everything was gray and bleak, and she suddenly realized that she really was 70 years old, and that she may not have had a lot of time in life, and that she had a lot of regrets for the time she lived her life. So the obsession was a kind of illusion that made her life feel quite different from what it was. And then what happened was that I, in my sort of rattling things up as much as I could to make some kind of change, what I did was to, in a sense, reinstitute the old patterns. I got the two of them back together. She continued to give him all the power. So I was dissatisfied with the change. She was very pleased with it, though. She had reestablished contact with him.
Mm.
And, of course, the real irony of this was part of a research program, and the researchers looked at outcome, and as psychotherapy research often has to look at very superficial things, how people are feeling, how depressed are they on a scale, and she turned out to be a real winner on each of these outcome measures.
Yeah.
But inwardly, I knew this lady had not really changed.
What you, in your work with people, obviously you get to know them quite well, and get to care about them, and what do you do with the feelings that come from an unsatisfactory conclusion like this, where you perhaps you feel that it didn't turn out the way that you might have hoped?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a sense, what can one say? I guess I have to I have to absorb that kind of pain, and I also have to take a look at what my ambitions were in the first place. In this story, I accused myself of having some hubris, you know, that I felt that I could do things that perhaps others couldn't do. If one looks back upon my beginning with her, she had had 20 years of psychotherapy with a lot of different therapists, and somehow I felt, I think I was grandiose enough to think, well, I had a different kind of therapy. I could do something different. I was more experienced than a lot of the students she had worked with. So what, you know, one starts to look back over the case. One talks with one's buddies and other therapists, you know. We often do that. We talk about some of our disappointments. Most therapists have a little group of people they get together, and sometimes it's a formal group. We meet once every couple of weeks, and one of us takes turns discussing cases, and usually what we do is discuss some of our disappointing cases to find out, well, what went wrong? What do we learn from this so that we can do it differently the next time? So there are always disappointments in therapy.
Our guest this morning is Dr. Irvin Yalom. He is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine. We're talking about some of the stories in his book, Love's Executioner and Other Tales of Psychotherapy. We have a caller, someone who's been waiting patiently for a bit here. We're happy to take other questions, comments. The local number is 333-9455 and the toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's our first caller on our toll-free line.
Good morning, David. Another interesting program. I would just like to make a comment and then give a question. I've got to get off then.
Sure.
What you're saying seems to be very, very universal to many people. I've been involved in a singles group in a local church, and quite often this obsession tendency comes in. It brought to mind a book that I read a couple of years ago entitled How to Break Your Obsession to a Person. Your Addiction to a Person by Howard Halpern, and I wonder if your guest had heard of this and what he thinks of Halpern's strategies. I can't remember too many. I think he was getting on it when I was when he was describing the past failed relationship. I'll get off the line now. I've got to go somewhere, but I'm taping the show. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Well, there are a lot of self-help books about how to break a love addiction, and I think some of them contain some behavioral methods that are important. In other words, they deal with the actual symptom. And I use some of these approaches too. There some of them are pretty simplistic. You know, you'll say one of the ways that behavioral therapists work with obsessions, well, you catch yourself obsessing about something and then you simply yell stop at the top of your lungs. Hopefully you're alone at this time. As a way of breaking the thought process, you start to keep track of exactly how many times a day you're thinking about this person. Or you even give yourself set times to think about the person. Or other things, you begin to try to imagine this person that you've idealized in some sort of more banal situation, doing something that may be somewhat less than dignified. Or even imagine this person in diapers, you know, as a child or so. Try to bring home to you the unrealistic quality of the obsession. So I think the actual behavioral methods for breaking the obsession sometimes for some people can be helpful. You may end up not learning a whole lot about yourself. So sometimes a problem like that is a good route into really learning and educating yourself about some of your deeper wishes and motivations and longings. And furthermore, just breaking the symptom doesn't give you a whole lot of protection against the same thing occurring next week.
Well, I hope that gets the question of the caller, and of course other people who would like to call in are welcome to do that. Let's talk a little bit about the woman in the chapter that you titled Fat Lady. Mm-hmm. This woman, this is Betty. We're going to give her the name Betty. She came to you, and she was very heavy. And she was apparently always overweight, but became obese when she was in her late adolescence. And since she was 21, she had weighed somewhere between 200 and 250 pounds. So she was very unhappy. She had no friends. She had no social life. She realized that her eating was out of control. She'd been warned by a physician that it was endangering her health, and she came to you for help. And at first you admit very honestly, at first you had a problem with her because of her size.
Yes, that's right, and that is a rather shocking beginning to the story, I know, and I've offended a whole lot of readers, and and a few reviewers as well. I think the Chicago Tribune started their review with that sort of line and saying, you know, these are excellent stories by a flawed therapist because I have this kind of prejudice. But of course, you know, and I exaggerated a little bit for the dramatic effect, but I did start saying here, and I did have some prejudice against fat women. They're people that at times I've never gotten to know. I feel somewhat repelled by when I first started to see Betty. And that presented all kinds of problems for me. You know, and for one thing, the problem is that the way that I feel that I can help someone else, the way that any therapist helps someone else, is to form a very honest and authentic relationship with that person. So then you really have to ask yourself, well, how can you form a relationship with someone that's dedicated to honesty and genuineness when you've got all these negative feelings about the way they look? So that was the basic theme of the story, how one solves that particular paradox. And therapists have to work with this in other ways, too. You know, how does a person who grew up with alcoholic parents deal with a person who has a drinking problem? You know, there's all kinds of negative feelings attached to that. So we all have issues that we have to deal with, which we call countertransference, some irrational feelings therapist has to the patient. So that was the first thrust of the story of how I kind of worked through some of my own negative feelings towards her and how I could help recognize, you know, the sort of struggling, likable human being in this person, allow that person to emerge for me as well as for herself.
What I think what makes the story so fascinating is that, and I think it's the case in with some of the other the stories that you tell too, that people came to you with one set of problems, and what was really going on was perhaps something else that was buried at a much deeper level, and that once you started to delve into the problems that were nearer to the surface, then it became obvious that they were tied or rooted in some ground that was much deeper. And that in her case, that her father had died of cancer, and she felt very close to him, and that one of the things that happened, he apparently had also been very heavy himself, and that as his disease progressed, he lost a lot of weight. And that somehow, on some level of her thinking, she had watched that, and on some level she associated losing weight with being sick and dying, and that there was something at a very deep level in her mind blocking her ability to herself lose weight because it had this association with her father's death. And in addition, it seemed that she was still perhaps still grieving in a way because she had been very close to her father and felt that when he was gone that she was alone, there was no one around to protect her, and that so there was this connection of the ideas of death and abandonment, and somehow it got connected with the issue of size and weight, and that was what was at the root of all of it. And once you got to that, she was able to confront her weight problem. Although, again, you know, it makes it sound very easy. I mean, it was a real struggle for her all the way through.
That's right. Well, as we started to work, she and I, the first thing, as I mentioned earlier, we had to work towards forming some kind of relationship. And one of the first things we had to do was to get through this whole initial veneer she had of being boring, and her being boring took the form of trying somehow to entertain me. It's as though she felt so empty inside, the only way she could relate to people was to be jolly and to amuse them in some way, and she did that with me for a long time, until gradually I got her permission and I could begin to call her on that and begin to wonder, and then we got into her sense of emptiness inside that she had nothing to offer, and then into some depressed feelings of depression. And then after that, we began to then approach the feelings she was having at deeper levels. And one way or the other, almost so many of the themes we got to led us to hearing more about the death of her father when she was a teenager, and which she had never really come to terms with. And it was a remarkable series of events that occurred once she started to lose weight. I didn't want to get into the same kind of control issues that so many other people in her life had done of trying to force her to lose weight, and I felt that I was going to have to trust her own willingness to change and to grow, and all I did was try to remove obstacles, and she finally one day then made the resolve to lose weight and began to lose weight at an amazing clip. But one of the things that happened when she lost weight is that she went through a series of flashbacks in which she very vividly recalled events in her life, and it was quite amazing that these events were the events that occurred when she was that particular weight in her life, because she had lost more weight than she had lost for 10 years or so. And she lost the weight that she was weighing when then she was in high school and when she was graduating junior high school, and she got closer and closer to the weight that she was when her father died. And at that point, she really recaptured a lot of the feelings around her father's death, what it meant to her, what the loss meant to her. And maybe even more important than that, she got in touch with her fears of death in general. You know, that the death of another brings you into contact with some of your fears of your own mortality. And so that was where a lot of the healing work came about. And after that, the loss of weight and the gradual learning to relate to other people as a non or as an ex-fat woman became more easy and more natural.
Well, I guess this morning, let me tell you again, it's Dr. Irvin Yalom. We're talking about his book, Love's Executioner and Other Tales of Psychotherapy. Once again, our guest this morning is Dr. Irvin Yalom. He's a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine and is the author of the book, Love's Executioner and Other Tales of Psychotherapy. It's published by Basic Books. We welcome your thoughts. If you'd like to talk with us, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Yalom, I wonder, and you touched on this a little bit ago, whether some of your colleagues don't feel that you have been a little too frank in writing these stories and publishing them in a form that is going to be accessible to a lot of people. Obviously, therapists do write up case studies, but probably most of them are only read by other therapists. This was something that's really intended for reading by a general audience. Have you been criticized by some of your colleagues?
You know, that has not occurred. In fact, not at all. One might have anticipated that, but I've written a great deal for professional audiences in the past. Basic textbooks in the field of what we can call existential psychotherapy and group psychotherapy, and these books have been sort of textbooks for a number of years. And in a sense, this new book, Love's Executioner, was meant to be a series of illustrative teaching tales. Mm-hmm. So they're meant as serious tales. They're meant as parables in a sense, and my intention was to use them to teach patients and therapists more about the process of psychotherapy. I originally was going to go about making them much more didactic by having an afterword on each story to kind of cover some of the more theoretical aspects, but that seemed to be too heavy. The publisher felt strongly that I should not do that, but I still kept two of the afterwards, so two of the 10 stories have some more of a professional afterword on them. But they're serious stories. They're meant to deal with deeper issues. And in a sense, the tradition that I'm writing and thinking of, sort of an approach to life through an existential kind of perspective, is sometimes these concepts are about existence and life and death and freedom and responsibility and meaning in life are very difficult to write about in just a surely abstract way. Mm. That one needs to somehow have some power and the power of some type of literary device to have people experience them at a deeper level. And a lot of people who've worked in this area have done the same thing. You know, I can talk about some very illustrious forebears like, you know, Sartre and Camus and Unamuno, all of whom were teaching these kinds of issues, and all of whom found that a literary conveyance was the most powerful way to teach. So that's the sense, the tradition in which I'm telling. connection that I'm making in there, I don't have any concerns about that at all, because I think that's the heart of psychotherapy. I think that there needs to be an honest, genuine relationship with the patient, and I try to be quite open and honest with my feelings about what's going on in therapy with that patient. If the patient recognizes something about you and asks you about it, and you deny something that's true, then you're engaged in something that's counter-therapeutic. You know, you're denying the patient's reality.
Hmm. The two stories that we have talked about, here, obviously, here are two women who are very different, who come to you with different problems, and yet it seems on a very fundamental level the problem is much the same. And it seems to come up in many of these stories. We have here, first of all, a woman who is obsessed with a brief love affair that she had 8 years before with a younger man and doesn't want to let go of it. We have the story of a woman who is obese and can't seem to control her eating. There was a story, for example, where a man comes to you and he has a series of love letters that were written to him by a woman with which he'd had an affair many years before. In fact, the woman had been dead for a long period of time.
Yes.
And the man comes to you and he says, look, I've got these letters, and would you keep them for me? Because I'm very concerned that if something would happen to me, my wife would find them and she'd read them and be very upset. And your natural question to him is, well, when was the last time you read any of these? And he said, well, maybe it had been 15 or 20 years. And you said to him, well, why do you keep them? And he seemed to feel it was almost that with like a foolish question. You're asking him why he keeps them.
Yes.
And what it's at root of this story seems to be what's at root of the other stories. It's people's fears about dying, about their own mortality, and in particular about isolation, abandonment, loneliness, and the ways in which they're tied to that same theme, people's fears about dying, and particularly fears about being alone at death, and how it is one of those things that one must do alone. It's a theme that comes up again and again.
Yes.
For you, is that the fundamental issue that everyone must confront, and the root of so much of our problems in life is that's where it is rooted in fears about death?
Well, I think that it's a universal feeling and fear, and it's obviously a fear that we've been struggling with as human beings ever since time began, that we've all tried to do something to deal with our great sense of smallness, of pacing, and what's often religious theorists call the tremendum, the sense of smallness and insignificance in the face of this enormous universe, so that we have to deal with that. And we've done so by creating immortality beliefs, theistic beliefs, something to sort of assuage our loneliness and fears of death. So I do believe that, I agree with what you're saying. I do believe that there are the anxiety stemming from our knowledge of death. And the more self-awareness we have about these processes, as Kierkegaard says, you know, that anxiety is the price we pay for self-awareness. So the more that we know about ourselves in the world, the more sort of inevitable kinds of anxieties that we'll feel. But to answer a question which you haven't quite asked yet, but I think you're leading towards, but I don't think these occur in every patient. Mm. You know, I don't try to take each patient to these sort of routes. In fact, I don't take any patient towards any kind of route. One of the approaches that I try to take in therapy is that you approach each patient very differently, very separately, without any preconceived theories or ideas. I don't like the idea of psychiatric diagnosis. I don't like you forming a diagnosis in the first session. Somehow you're approaching the patient thereafter with that sort of sense of diagnosis, because I think it then begins to limit what you see and what you allow the patient to experience. So for some patients, some stages of their therapy, some of these fears play enormous roles, and the therapist has to be prepared to see them and to deal with them. And other patients, it will be something entirely different. For other patients, some of the major concerns may
I have a couple of callers here, and I apologize to them because I've kept them waiting.
Okay.
We'll get right to them. Let's go first to line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
You're kind of faint. It would help us if you would speak up a little bit. Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
All right. Good morning. This is Dr. Richards. I'm a psychiatrist, by the way, and I was intrigued by your comments there regarding diagnosis, etc., and your other comments regarding individualization of your approach. Would you care to comment about the conflicts relative to passing board certification examinations with your ideas about diagnosis?
Well, it's a tough question. It's a real problem. One of the problems that's going on in the field of psychiatry today, especially with its remedicalization, in which we are taught and we teach our residents, you know, that this is a science and there are certain fixed diagnoses that we have to go through, and indeed there are some important diagnostic decisions that we need to make, especially around the major sort of psychotic illnesses, which seem to have a clear biological genetic component, like a major mania or depressive illness, and in which medication may be useful. But aside from these, the kind of finer distinctions that we make between a lot of personality disorders are extremely evanescent. They change every few years, and I have never found them to be much value. There's certainly not much value in psychotherapy to me. So I have lots of concern about that. It's one of the reasons why I've never participated as an examining member of the boards.
Uh-huh. Well, I enjoyed hearing about this. I'll ring off now and listen to the show some more.
Okay. Well, I thank you for the call. Let's go to a second caller. We have someone here on our line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Dr. Yalom, have you written under your actual name, or is this a non-diplome name?
Oh, no, this is my actual name.
This is your name. Well, the thing that concerns me is, had I been one of your patients and read this book, I feel that it would be easy for me to identify myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what harm, after possibly a successful diagnosis and a change, I'm just wondering if this wouldn't carry me back to the original situation that was so distressing me and make me wonder if I had been used.
Well, let's stay with that for just a minute. First of all, I need to tell you that if you had been one of the people that I wrote about, then I would have talked to you about this at great length, and that you would have read the story in an early form and given me permission to do that and check the disguise in there and see whether that was adequate. And in fact, give me your permission to use the story, and had you any objection, I wouldn't have used it. So that you have to know at first. Every patient read every single word of his or her story and felt that it was something that they would give me permission to do because they felt that it would be useful to the profession, to other people who were dealing with the kinds of problems that they were dealing with. But given that, tell me why it would take you back to your original illness if you were to see this.
Well, I don't know. I've never been in psychoanalysis, but I've read quite a bit about it, and it just seems that I just think that I would feel used, and this help that I got from you was maybe a superficial thing that was done in order to give you something to write about.
Oh, I see. So you thought the reason that I was really seeing you was in order to write about you.
Possibly, yes.
I see. I wonder what would make you think that. Let's say that we were meeting for a couple of years, that we seemed to be working well together, and at the end of that I had written something and showed it to you, and I say, I wonder how you would feel about my writing this. I think you've done a lot of good work together, and maybe there's something here that others in your situation could learn from it.
Well,
and realize, of course, that I'm disguising everything extremely heavily.
Mm-hmm. Well, very possibly under that situation, I would agree, and
yeah.
and it would seem all right. But as an onlooker,
yeah. Well, that was the situation, and I said that in my introduction to the book, that I consulted with each person very thoroughly about each of the stories and did elicit their cooperation. And I think most of the people did feel good about that. You know, some of the one or two of the people, for example, the woman who was very obese, one thing she asked me, would I mind sending her letters that I had gotten from people who were obese and who profited from reading that? And indeed, I did get letters not only from people who were obese, but from therapists who were working with obese people who said that the story had been helpful, and I did send them to her. So, you know, I did not have a sense. I mean, I think you're raising an important issue, but I did not have a sense of having violated any of the patients at all, but that we were working together, allies in this.
I guess this question comes to my mind because I hear and read so many books and hear the authors interviewed, and it seems like is the way for a professional to make some additional money. And sometimes I feel that the person being written about is not really being treated fair. But obviously you did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the only way we can really teach in my field. You know, that we're dealing with people's stories all the time. And all my other textbooks have always vignettes, a page or two about a certain incident. But if I want to teach a whole course of psychotherapy, I've got to use a longer instance of this. Otherwise, there's no way to pass this on to other students and to other would-be patients so they can get an idea what the process is really like.
We just have a couple of minutes left. One of the things that I wanted to ask you was, it seems that one of the curious things about neuroses and, I don't know, maybe also psychoses, is that they can really be coping strategies. They can be, in a warped sort of a way, they can be supports for people. And that in the process of therapy, and you can see it in some of the stories we've talked about and others that we haven't, what part of what you have to do, in a sense, is to yank those out from under people, which must mean that there are frightening moments when the patient realizes that has happened, and you know that you have done it, and perhaps do you ever wonder to yourself whether that was really helpful, or whether you have pulled out a support for the person and don't have anything to put in its place?
Well, I think your point's very well taken. It is true that neurotic approaches are a type of support for the person, and that's something that we've known for a very long time. In fact, that was something that really Freud first recognized. But the issue is that the person pays too high a price for that support, and so the person becomes extremely crippled in many ways, and his life becomes narrower and narrower and narrower. Say that the symptom is a kind of phobia where he's frightened of talking to other people, and so that he begins to avoid people more and more and shuts himself in the house. Well, in a sense, he avoids the anxiety of talking to people or of going outside, so that the phobia is working by removing his anxiety. But at the same time, the price he pays for it is so heavy that he doesn't get a chance to live any kind of decent life at all. And so you have to then begin to offer that patient something else. And that's where the relationship comes in. The person begins then to learn what it is like to relate to the therapist, to relate to another person, to realize that there's no harm that will come to him once he begins to reveal himself and to open up. And so then gradually, once he begins to understand that there is no kind of impending automatic catastrophe in being different, he gradually allows the symptoms to slip away.
We're just about out of time, and my apologies to a caller. I'm not going to be able to take just one final question. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about, and that is how the process of doing therapy has changed you?
Oh, I think therapists change a great deal throughout their careers from doing therapy. In fact, I think therapists are almost, what should I say, I think that we're continuously in therapy. Because we're continuously looking at our own reactions, wondering how we're responding to that person. And I also think that therapists should be in professional therapy more than one time in their lives, too. I urge all my students to seek professional therapy because we ourselves are our most valuable professional tool. So we've got to know if our reaction to the patient is coming from some of our own sort of neurotic feelings and needs, or our reaction to the patient is actually more inherent in what the patient is doing. So the therapists need to see a great deal of themselves. And as people go through different changes in their life cycle, they may need to work on different kinds of themes. So it may be that therapists, like all of us, need to go back into therapy on more than one occasion. I certainly have.
Well, we will have to leave it at that. We have obviously just told a few of the stories in the book. There are many others, and I think it's quite fascinating. I appreciate you being with us to talk about it today.
I appreciate your inviting me.
Our guest is Dr. Irvin Yalom. That's Yalom. And his book is entitled Love's Executioner and Other Tales of Psychotherapy. Basic Books is the publisher.